The impact of technology is prompting businesses to rethink everything from marketing to customer service. But what does the business landscape of the future actually look like? Find out when we return to the Transformation Minute from Comcast Business.
This is your tech news briefing for Friday, December 27th. I'm Kateri Yoakum from the Wall Street Journal in New York. All this week, we've been talking about how tech has changed our lives over the past decade. We've talked about big tech, streaming, smartphones. Those elements and many, many more have changed the way we communicate, travel, eat, work. And for CEOs, they've changed their job descriptions. Today, our Charlie Turner sits down with reporter John Stoll to talk about how tech has impacted the corner office. That's after the break.
Welcome back to the Transformation Minute from Comcast Business. How will the business landscape of the future look different from where we are today? We asked Denise Hasty, SVP of Comcast Business.
There's been a major paradigm shift across all industries. In banking, expect to see virtual financial experts for financial consulting and planning. They'll be communicating with their customers via video. At the same time, authentication will likely evolve to use biometrics. Passwords may actually become a thing of the past.
John, as you wrote in your piece, a decade ago, the world was waiting for the other shoe to drop. We had just experienced the financial crisis of 2008, and we were just getting back on our feet as an economy. What did the job of CEO look like back then?
Yeah, I think there was a lot more concern 10 years ago about just the general fragility of the economy. Could we trust regulators? Could we trust interest rate setters? Could we trust the sort of the fabric of what was holding together the global economy with what was going on in the EU? There was general distrust of all of that 10 years ago. I mean, you didn't know if we were going to go through a double-dip recession. The financial crisis had been just so traumatic, and it did touch every industry that it took several years to really emerge from that with the sense of, okay, this economy's rolling, we can begin to invest again, begin to hire again, and begin to think about innovation in leaps and bounds of several years versus just trying to make incremental innovation. So investment started to roll sometime well after the financial crisis. But yes, definitely the beginning of the decade was a worrisome time for any CEO in any industry.
Well, let's break down sort of piece by piece the technological factors that have driven some of the intense change we've seen in the corner office. First and foremost, probably social media. In 2009, it was in its earliest stages. How has social media changed what we expect from CEOs?
Yeah, I don't think we necessarily expect them all to be tweeting and on Facebook and on Instagram as much as we expect them to be responsive to how small and how fast the world has gotten with its response to crisis or trends or what's popular. Anything from the most recent examples with Peloton, the exercise company, and some of their ads that didn't go over too well, to earlier this year with Boeing, definitely got into some real hot water with some of the technologies on their planes and some of the fatalities that were related to not having everything in order there. And then in front of that, you had a lot of CEOs being pulled into a tumultuous time with the President of the United States, who likes to tweet, obviously, and that creates a whole other layer of communication and skill that the CEO didn't have to have, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago. A slight miscalculation in the way that a company presents itself on social, doesn't communicate fast enough, can lead to a barrage of criticism, not just in newspapers and in the marketplace, but just in a general arena of public opinion because it's all become so condensed on social media.
Social media has also heightened this expectation of corporate social responsibility. It allows companies to engage more directly with their customers, and it pushes CEOs to be social justice warriors. Who have been some of the winners and losers in this arena?
Yeah, I think by all means, any company that has a strong front on issues like climate change, gender equality, issues that are not always going to make a big difference in the ledger and in the dollars and cents, but issues that are really near and dear to, in particular, millennials who are shopping much more with their hearts than just their wallets these days. They're making decisions based on companies they believe in. You know, one of the interesting test cases has been Nike, a shoe company that is ubiquitous, that has been built on the strength of its affiliation with athletes and performance. And recently they've had to make some tough decisions. And, you know, this is obviously around Colin Kaepernick, an NFL player who's not even playing anymore, but is associated with the brand almost as much these days as Michael Jordan. Not quite, but he's on a level that very few athletes have been affiliated with Nike in the past. And that's because they've stood behind him. They've advertised in his favor. They've said that the steps that he took when he was on the football field, kneeling during the national anthem, basically equating that to a courageous step on his part. Now, recently, the company's had to be very mindful of the fact that not everybody clearly likes kneeling during the national anthem. They have a broad customer base, and they need to be able to play in both the arena of understanding the sensitivity of the part of its buyer base that doesn't agree with that, but the fact that most of its most loyal and passionate buyers will back Colin Kaepernick. And so they've had to make business decisions that, you know, sometimes isolate and ostracize part of its buyer base in order to continue to be edgy and continue to be progressive and continue to look at like it's on the social edge versus being behind some of these issues. So recently with a tennis shoe that Colin Kaepernick thought was offensive, the Betsy Ross shoe, they had to pull that from the market. Again, I think it was about fearing backlash on social media. It wasn't necessarily a worry about getting hit with boycotts and things like that. I mean, social media is so powerful right now, and CEOs are clearly very aware that they can be criticized heavily in a heartbeat.
I'm talking with John Stoll of the Wall Street Journal. Moving on here, John, there's also a different kind of pressure, the rise of the FANG companies, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, the five most popular tech stocks out there. They've developed enormous power. Can you tell us about their influence on business decisions?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to talk about in the context of the last decade or decade plus. If you think about 10, 12 years ago, these companies, not Apple necessarily, but Amazon for sure, Facebook, Netflix, Spotify, you go down the list of major tech disruptors, major tech companies, which almost every customer now interacts with. 10, 12 years ago, these companies were in their infancy. We didn't know the kind of influence they were going to have on the marketplace or even on technology, much less, you know, overall American life. Today, they're ubiquitous. Everybody has Netflix. Everybody streams their music. Rarely do you see physical copies of movies and CDs and items like that. And meanwhile, there's an increasing number of people shopping online, either through Amazon or now through their competitors. Every CEO has had to respond faster than they ever thought they would to these disruptive forces. I had a session with a number of CEOs last week in Washington where some of these companies have very little technology built into the way that they do business. They make nuts and bolts or widgets and washing machines and things like that. They aren't high-tech features, but they realize that it might be in the way that they talk to customers. It might be in the way they manage their supply chains. FANG, these Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, have changed the way that just the central business is done. And I'll just give you a quick example. If you think about Amazon and what we know them for, which is an online bookseller, now an online goods seller, their money machine is cloud computing. And that is a completely different, you know, animal than what we associated Amazon with 15 years ago. But they've just changed the way that we store data and we move data. And Microsoft and IBM, old blue chips, have had to catch up. So you see this every day in every headline in the Wall Street Journal. It seems that these companies are influencing the day-to-day business decisions across industries and across a company.
What about artificial intelligence, the mechanization of basic tasks? That's beginning to change the makeup of the workforce. As employers, how have companies had to adapt?
Yeah, this is the mega trend to watch. I think, for one, employment base, the workforce is getting older. People are waiting longer to get into the workforce because they're going to college longer, what have you. And so the basic complexion of who a worker is and what their skill set is and what their mentality is changing. In walks artificial intelligence. We are not new to the story of automation. The 1980s and 1990s were a lot about the robotification of plants and making sure that you had as many robots as were prudent to take out a lot of the human capital and increase efficiency. Now we're in an age when, you know, again, it's much like the conversation that we're having about Amazon or Facebook and their wide influence over business. Artificial intelligence and the ability to manipulate, collect, and analyze and apply data to the basic business operations of what you do, it's table stakes. If you're not using data, whether it's customer data or logistics data or employee data, you're going to be caught short against competitors who are probably more nimble. They may not have as much capital, but they're able to use artificial intelligence, able to use the machine learning to create a better mousetrap. Now, on the employment side, I think this is about making workers better. I've done a lot of work on talking with employment economists who see a changing but not necessarily a shrinking workforce in the United States. And if people are going to get older, they're going to need more automated tasks. If workers are in general older, if the workforce is more 55 and less 25, you're going to need tasks where computers are really assisting and aiding and keeping the momentum going, where the people are further removed from education or further removed from, you know, their prime years. You're going to see artificial intelligence come in and do a big job there. Today, I think we're still in the early innings, the very early innings of this. We hear a lot about automation in like an Amazon logistics warehouse, or you hear a lot about automation at Tesla. I've been to the Tesla plant. There's still thousands of people working. And that doesn't mean that they're going to be replaced, but the ability to efficiently move products through a production system or through a supply chain, I think this is going to be, over the next 10 years, we're going to be having a conversation in 2030 about rapid development and major development that's happened in that area over the decade to come.
John, it used to be that CEOs could set a 5-year plan and work toward that goal. With new technology advancing so quickly and the public essentially reacting in real time through social media, is a 5-year plan really possible anymore?
It doesn't feel like it is. And I think there's a couple of things that CEOs have told me, whether it's Indra Nooyi, who ran Pepsi for many years, or Eva Carlson running Houdini, a small manufacturer of clothing. And, you know, I've talked to folks who are in the financial industry. And a couple of things are changing the ability to really look out 5 years, because you had this kind of expectation on CEOs many years ago to set out that 5-year plan and then go meet them. It could be profit, it could be revenue goals, the EPS, return on capital investment. And that stuff, that pressure doesn't go away, but it is becoming more difficult. And one of the factors that is making it more difficult is this rapid change in technology. You really don't know what's going to happen in 2020 in terms of the rate of advancement and the size of innovation. So, yeah, I think ubiquitously I've got CEOs saying it is very difficult to look 1 year out, much less 5. That doesn't take the pressure off them. They have to do it. But, boy, you better be ready to rip those plans up, be nimble, and be responsive to consumers who are seemingly constantly demanding faster and better productivity out of their companies.
I guess this is related. From where you sit right now, what do you expect the biggest challenges will be for CEOs going into the next decade?
The knee-jerk is for CEOs to say, talent. There always is this concern about, particularly with companies that have big workforces, are they going to be able to staff them with the types of people, both in the C-suite and white-collar level and on the blue-collar level, with folks that can come up with new ideas and execute on new ideas. Below that is going to be this thing that we talk about with trying to resolve uncertainty. Uncertainty doesn't go away. But with these inputs of trade wars and sort of this regulatory guessing game that's going on, those are things that will eventually become industry changers. And so the companies that actually begin to adopt new strategies, new ideas, new products, companies that we don't even know about today could be, you know, the next Amazons, the next Facebooks, the next Netflix 10 years from now.
Wall Street Journal reporter John Stoll. John, thanks a lot.
Yeah, no problem.
And that was your Tech News Briefing. I'm Kateri Yoakum from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.